Millions of Americans live with mental illness every day. Today's guest is a poet and author whose writing explores the stigmas and biases associated with mental illness. She's Sarah Fawn Montgomery this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. To do that, we sit down every week with the best storytellers around, filmmakers, authors, journalists, and more, to make sense of the big stories that shape public life in the United States today. This week, we're joined by Sarah Fawn Montgomery, a poet and author whose explorations of mental illness are frank and unflinching. Sarah Fawn, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So we want to talk to you about your work and your scholarship, but I want to talk to you first, though. When did you know you wanted to be a writer?
Oh, goodness. Probably fourth grade. I started rewriting Charlotte's Web, and I wanted to tell a story where Wilbur wasn't the hero or Charlotte was the hero. So there was a gruesome murder involved of Wilbur. And yeah, that was probably when I decided I wanted to do it. And then I just wrote all throughout.
And so this is something that I obviously at a very early age. When did you actually sort of realize that you sort of you had the chops to be a published author, a published poet?
I applied for graduate school for an MFA program because I wanted to have time to write. Probably still didn't believe that I could do it. And I had a teacher there, a wonderful writer named Stephen Church, who said, of course you want to send this out. Of course you want to publish. And I said, oh, okay, I'll try it. And so about halfway through my master's program is actually when I thought that I could do it. And then I was really lucky and got things accepted pretty quickly. And then it kind of spun from there.
Well, luck is one thing, but.
So where did you do your schooling?
Oh, go ahead.
Track your course through school.
Yeah, I'm from California originally, so I did my undergrad at California State University, Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo, and then I did my graduate work, my MFA, at California State University, Fresno. They've got a really fantastic MFA program, and there I specialized in nonfiction writing and did quite a bit of literary editing and publishing exposure through the different internships and programs they had. And then I did a PhD at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where I specialized in creative writing, so nonfiction, memoir primarily. I also began writing poetry at that point, and then I specialized in gender studies.
So poetry came a little later in terms of your writings. What attracted you to poetry?
I wanted to try something that I didn't think I could do. I wanted to
really
try thinking differently. Yeah, I always thought of myself as a primarily a nonfiction writer, never really tried fiction, never tried writing poetry, and I was surrounded by really great poets, and I said, I want to see if I can do that. And I worked with a really wonderful poet named Ted Kooser. He's the former poet laureate, and he said that poetry should be accessible, that it shouldn't be hard, that it shouldn't be something that you have to be very special to do and have to have advanced schooling to do. So I tried writing some narrative poems, and it kind of went from there.
Talk to us a little bit. I mean, you've given us just a glimpse already, though, sort of the power of mentorship and sort of these people who sort of helped you along this course. Talk to us about those people and how important they are in a young writer's life.
Oh, having a mentor is everything. As readers, we're sitting at home by ourselves usually. We're reading alone, and writing and reading are very solitary acts. But you get excited, and you get excited about the literary world and engaging in that when you have people you can talk to it with. So my mentors and teachers really were sort of influential for me. I had a wonderful teacher in high school as well who first got me writing nonfiction. We had a reading journal we had to do, and I wrote far beyond the exceeded word limit. And she read it all and gave me feedback and was wonderful and lovely about it. And so that's what I try to do with my own students is, share the work, read the work, get excited about the work, and think of it as experimentation and play rather than work itself. Mm. Yeah.
So you obviously were good at poetry. You had your first book, The Astronaut Checks His Watch. It was a collection of poems, mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
The Astronaut Checks His Watch is a collection of narrative poems. So they all sort of tell the same story of a central figure. And it's a figure I wanted to write about part a real person, but also part sort of imaginary character. I wanted to tackle the addiction narrative and to think about why people turn to addiction, what addiction does in the brain. And so I have this character of the astronaut who, you know, a man who always wanted to go into space, who always wanted to be able to leave Earth in that way, wasn't able to do that, and so began leaving Earth through drug use in some sense and alcohol. And so all the poems are interconnected using space imagery and space research, but also some addiction imagery as well.
One critic called it deeply political at its core. What was the politics in this collection of poetry?
I'm working with the idea of boundaries. I'm working with the idea of, again, sort of the addiction narrative and trying to challenge the addiction narrative to humanize it in some senses, because we often don't think of the human story behind narratives of addiction. And then the idea of, again, sort of boundaries. So what are the political boundaries? What are the personal boundaries? What are the physical boundaries that bind you to the earth versus those that allow you to leave in some sense? Hmm.
Next book was Leaving Tracks, A Prairie Guide, and I'm guessing that came out of your time in Nebraska.
Yes.
And
yes.
You had never really spent much time in Nebraska, born and raised in California. There you are in the Midwest.
Yeah. From California, moved to Nebraska for graduate school. I always say I fell in love with Nebraska. I love the Midwest. It's got a bad reputation, I think, by Californians especially, who go, well, what is there to do there? There's a lot to do there. It's beautiful and it's peaceful. I found it very restorative. And so that collection is looking at narratives of the prairie, narratives of Great Plains mythology, trying to break some of those more traditional, idyllic, pastoral narratives with more honest narratives about the Midwest. A lot of bison poems, because I love a good bison poem.
Well,
I can't help it. Who doesn't love a bison poem? Yeah. A lot of poems about prairie grass, because it's complex and really hardy, and a lot of people don't realize the history of prairie grass. So,
talk about writing poetry, the craft of it. I mean, do you have a time of day that you do it? Does inspiration come to you? Do you keep notes?
I
know nothing about writing poetry, only reading poetry, but nothing about writing it.
I keep a list of ideas, so if I see a neat TV show, I'm all about National Geographic. If I'm watching a great show on National Geographic and I want to write a poem about a cool fish I see, I'll put it on the list. I just try to sort of notice, but I would say I get the majority of my ideas for poems, whether it's topics or sort of craft techniques I want to try, just from reading. I'm someone who reads a lot. I try to read a book of poetry almost every day.
Really?
Yeah, it's beautiful. It allows you to slow down. I love the way that reading poetry changes the way you interact with reading, because it's meant to be read aloud. So when you read it out loud, or when you even sort of read it to yourself, you can feel the words in your mouth, right? You can feel them in your breath.
You know, listening to you talk about the Midwest, you mentioned born in California, you live on the East Coast now. You know, there's this narrative in American politics about flyover country, right? And that the coasts and the Midwest really have nothing in common. Having lived in all three regions, as we think about them from a political perspective, what do you make of that notion of flyover country?
Yeah, I mean, I can understand a lot of folks only ever visit the Midwest when they're on, you know, on a plane, and they're looking down and they're seeing the patchwork or the grid. When I first moved out there from California, I definitely had the California perspective of, oh, there's nothing here. I'm here for graduate school. But there's a really rich history, not just a history of farming, but a history of sort of settling and a history of having to really persevere in the face of some extreme weather, extreme hardship in terms of economics. It's actually quite diverse. A lot of folks don't believe the Midwest is diverse, but diverse in you know, plants and animal life, diverse in human life, quite diverse in terms of the different businesses that are there. Again, a lot of folks think it's farming, but there's a lot going on, a lot of good sort of educational opportunities and good colleges out there, a lot of tech, which a lot of people don't realize, but there's a lot of tech industry in the Midwest. So the notion of flyover country, I always think of as if you stop, if you slow down and you look, you'll see. But if you're in the mindset of just wanting to get from one coast to the next, you're going to miss out.
Is the experience, is the mindset that fundamentally different, though? Is there really that sort of cleavage in the American psyche between the Midwest and the coasts?
I didn't find that it was that different. The only thing that I found that was probably that different is that it encouraged me to slow down. And it could be, as I was aging, I was there at a different period of my life. But I really enjoyed the way that I had to be mindful in that space. I've only been on the East Coast for about a year and a half. And it is quicker. It moves a little bit quicker than the Midwest, for sure. But when I moved from California to the Midwest, I really appreciated that I had to sort of stop and get to know the area a little bit more. In California, I just sort of went about my day-to-day business. And in the Midwest, you often have to stop. The weather will make you stop, and you have to notice a little bit more, and I appreciated that.
Your third book of poetry seems to me to be a prelude to your current book, which we're going to get into and talk about for the rest of the show. But that was published in 2017. It's called Regenerate, Poems of Mad Women. What was in that collection?
That is a collection of poems, again, sort of narrative poems written by historical and literary mad women. They were women that you read about in different novels or women that you read about in different medical studies, but they often don't have a voice of their own. You hear them in terms of their name in Freud's medical study, or you hear them as, you know, it's Bertha Mason, the wife in Jane Eyre, but they never actually get to speak for themselves. And so what I did throughout that collection is I wrote persona poems from their perspectives. So I imagined what they might have to say if they were allowed to tell their stories. So trying to work against silence and erasure, trying to let them claim a narrative of madness. We often try to hide madness or to be secret about it, and I wanted them to claim their madness in some sense. So I have a lot of those sorts of poems, and then it's interwoven with some other poems from sort of imagined mad women. So some mad women from the plains, mad women that I imagined in different sort of time periods and spaces.
So that brings us to your current book, Quite Mad, an American Pharma Memoir. So it's nonfiction.
Yes, a memoir.
What was the origin of this book?
This book was the book that I wanted and that I needed when I was first a patient. I was diagnosed with severe anxiety disorder when I was in my early 20s, and then I was also diagnosed with pretty severe obsessive compulsive disorder and then post-traumatic stress disorder. And so as a patient, I was encountering pretty brief doctor visits, maybe 10 minutes or so, and I didn't get all the information that I wanted about my disorders, but also about the different treatments that I was encountering. So I really wanted to know more medical information, but then I also wanted more patient stories. So I wanted to hear from people like me about what they'd gone through. And so I decided to write the memoir. So it's my personal experience, but then it's interwoven with a lot of history. So research about the different medications I encountered, research about the history of mental illness treatment in the United States, and then also a discussion of gender and medical sexism and the way that influenced my experience, but also treatment throughout the United States history.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard 4 times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a remarkable crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. And if you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me, as he does every week in the co-host chair, is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who is the author of 17 books and is also an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is an author whose poetry and prose explore what it means to live with mental illness in the United States, now and across our history. Dr. Sarah Fawn Montgomery also teaches at Bridgewater State University in Massachusetts. You can find her on Twitter at @sfsarahfawn_Montgomery, MONTGOMERY.
So we're hoping you can read a little bit from the beginning of the book, and that was set during that time in your early 20s when this was all coming together for you.
Yes. So this is from the prologue. It's set, again, in my early 20s. At this point, I had just moved to Nebraska for my PhD. So I'd been experiencing anxiety for a couple of years at that point and had a couple of different medications I had tried with some pretty damaging side effects. Yeah. So I'll go ahead and read. This is from the prologue. I was 22 the first time I had a panic attack. One night, I took 2 ibuprofen and quickly became convinced I'd swallowed a handful. A burn enveloped my body. I lost my breath. My limbs went dead. And even though I felt trapped in the chaos, I also seemed to be floating above the scene, disconnected from the moment, powerless to stop whatever was seeping through me, building speed until it surged. I grew hysterical, pacing the house, hyperventilating and sweating, eventually cowering in a cold shower. Afraid to sleep after the attack, I spent much of the night retching and crying, gnarled fingers clutching at my unreliable heart. The attacks continued the next day and in the weeks after, building in frequency until I began experiencing a dozen each night, waking up in a cold sweat, unable to breathe, crying out as I clawed at my chest. Ever since, I've had attacks that stem from mundane things. Driving by a car accident causes catastrophic thoughts of my own mortality. A thunderstorm brings about thoughts of electrocutions, fantastic fireworks, making my body fluorescent. Unusually sore muscles leads to thoughts of cancer creeping through my body like a blush. Coming up the stairs and finding myself out of breath triggers a fear that I'm having an attack, and my body follows suit. It's mostly miserable, irritatingly irrational, entirely inexplicable. I'm afraid of dying a lot these days, so I retreat to bathrooms, bathtubs, the floor, trying to make the world disappear.
Wow.
Wow.
So, you mentioned your first panic attack was when you were 22. Mm-hmm. How long between that first panic attack and actually being diagnosed with anxiety disorder?
I'd have to think about that, and only because mental illness alters your sense of time in some sense. Probably 6 months, maybe a year even. It's actually a hard question for me to answer.
Was there a process you had to go through? I mean, I'm just thinking about, you know, you present to doctors with one thing, and sometimes they follow Occam's razor, and it's not necessarily where they need to take you.
Yeah, I was convinced I was just stressed, which it sounds silly now, but I was in graduate school, and I was very much following the graduate school narrative, which is you work hard, you work all the time, you don't do anything for fun, of course you're stressed, of course you're sick, which I think is also an American narrative. It's the business model that we like to follow. And I would say I probably figured out something was wrong when I started having panic attacks, you know, a dozen times a day, 20 times a day. It was very difficult for me to sort of make my way through my day. And my parents were the ones that said, we think there's something wrong. And I think, you know, while I had a very difficult journey sort of trying to find treatment, I'm appreciative of them for doing that, because I don't know if I would have thought there was anything wrong. I really just thought I was working hard.
Was there anybody else you could talk to about that? I mean, you were in Nebraska at that point. Friends or classmates or... I don't know, how many years ago was that, roughly?
About 10 years ago.
Okay, so stigma then, and of course still now, were major issues. Was there anybody you could talk to and say, here's what's going on, what do you think?
I had friends, a few close friends that knew. My partner at the time, who's now my husband, knew about it. But I actually didn't talk about it very much. I was very, very much bought into the stigma of this is something that's wrong with me. I need to fix this on my own.
I can correct this if I only can summon the will and the strength. And, you know, again, that's almost like a sports metaphor.
Right. And it's ridiculous, too, because mental health, you need a community, and there's nothing shameful about it. Writing the book is what made me feel comfortable to talk about it. And now I'm not ashamed. I actually sort of value my mental illness experience. I think it makes me more insightful in a lot of ways. I think it makes me a more thoughtful teacher, maybe a more emotional writer in some senses. But at the time, I certainly didn't speak about it.
Behind you on the set is actually a portrait from a previous guest reminding us that 1 in 4 Americans have dealt with mental health or will deal with mental health issues in their lifetime. Why does that stigma still persist? I mean, that's a huge number, 25%. Why do you think the stigma continues to persist?
I think the narrative of mental illness flies in the face of the American sort of ideals of rugged individualism and American exceptionalism. We're a nation founded on the idea that if you work hard and you try your best, you'll be able to overcome any obstacle and you'll be able to achieve success. And mental illness, you can't control, and you can work as hard as you want on it and you still might not be able to control it. And it often seems, you know, it's illogical and it's beyond what you have ownership over. And so I think that's one of the reasons we have such stigma against talking about it. It's also perceived as weakness. It's often perceived as sort of frailty and faultiness, even though to live day to day with mental illness requires a tremendous amount of strength and courage. But those are some of those sort of deep-rooted ideas that we have about mental illness.
Is that one of the reasons you write so frankly about it? Do you see it as part of your mission to break down those stigmas?
A little bit. When I first started writing the book, I wanted to just sort of tell my story. I felt like I had done a lot of hiding when I didn't want to talk about it, and I felt like I'd done a lot of pretending, and so I just wanted to be honest. It's one of the things you do as a memoirist. You tell it like it is. But since then, especially, you know, going out and doing more speaking about it and book tour, and I visit a lot of colleges and talk with college students, I think it's really important to just be honest about it. And for me, I claim a mental illness diagnosis. I claim my anxiety identity. I claim obsessive compulsive disorder. I claim post-traumatic stress disorder, because they're part of me, just like anything else, just like hair color or eye color. And I'm not ashamed of them. And so, to be able to sort of claim that, that goes a long way too in healing in some sense.
How did you come to that understanding? I mean, that was a journey, clearly, and it's a really good place to be. Not everyone takes that journey and winds up in that good place to be. How did you get there? From the horror of what you described in your reading when you're 22 years old and what's going on to where you are now?
For me, it took a lot of sort of trial and error. I tried quite a few different medications that had pretty severe side effects for me that I describe in the book. This is not to say that medication is dangerous in any way. Medication is actually very important for a lot of folks. It allows a lot of people to get through day to day. But for me, I had a lot of severe reactions to medications early on. And I had a lot of folks who didn't necessarily believe me when I said, I think I'm having this side effect or I think this is happening.
Say a lot of folks, healthcare professionals.
Who are overworked and overburdened, right? And so this is not to sort of diminish the work that they do. But yeah, okay. A lot of folks who just didn't believe me when I said, I think my hair is falling out from this medication. Oh, no, you're making it up. Or, I think my...
They're treating you for anxiety disorder, so it's easy for them to say,
yeah.
You're worrying needlessly about this.
Exactly. Yeah. So I had a lot of that. It happened for about 10 years. And along that time, I decided that you could either fight it and you could try to get rid of it, or you could own it and you sort of claim it. And when I stopped thinking there was something wrong with me and stopped saying, well, my brain is broken, my body is broken, and started saying, no, it's just different. This is how I see things.
This is me.
Yeah, this is me. And what,
that's remarkable.
Yeah, what some people see as obsessive compulsive, it is obsessive compulsive disorder, but what some people see as tics or oddities, I just see as normal.
It's
just me.
Have you seen in the general culture in America, a diminishing of stigma in the 10 years that you've really been tuned into stigma and mental illness? Has there been more understanding? And what has brought us there, if there is?
I would say I see a lot more open dialogue. I'm very lucky to be able to work with college students as a professor, and so I'm working with undergraduate students and graduate students, and their willingness to be open about their own experiences is staggering to me. And so I would say that the stigma is shifting. We're having much more open dialogue, and that's because a lot of young folks are sharing stories in some really powerful ways and not being so afraid. And again, I encounter a lot of students. I teach creative writing, so they're writing memoir and nonfiction and poetry, but they're really brave in a lot of ways, and they're very open with wanting to talk about it and fix it and think critically about it.
That is so important to health and healing, being open and candid in conversation and listening and speaking.
Yeah. I also taught as part of a medical humanities program at the University of Nebraska for a while. So I was working with pre-med students and pre-nursing students. And so to be able to work with healthcare, and educate in terms of healthcare so that you're not just having patient perspective, but you're having physician and nursing perspective to think about these things and to talk about mental health in these ways was really beneficial.
So the subtitle, An American Pharma Memoir. I asked you about this before we started. Pharma, you're talking about the American pharmaceutical industry. Why is that so important to the story?
For me, as I mentioned before, I had a lot of pretty adverse side effects when it came to medication. I had significant hair loss from medication. I experienced akathisia, which is pretty unprompted rage, a lot of anger. It's a pretty severe side effect. I had vision changes. I had a lot of other things that I mentioned in the book. And so for me, writing this book was about finding a medication that worked for me. It's about thinking about over-medicating. Our prescription rates have gone up tremendously since the 1950s. There's troubling patterns when you look at prescribing rates. We tend to over-prescribe to women. We don't prescribe to men as much. You can look at age ranges and look at the ways that prescribing patterns are influenced by that.
Is it that women are overprescribed or are men underprescribed? Do we know?
Trends point to the fact that women are more likely to have their experiences medicalized. They're more likely to be diagnosed and prescribed. Oftentimes, we will say that female behavior or gendered behavior is madness when it's usually like female anger or female frustration. We tend to say, oh, you're acting crazy if someone's loud or is expressing distaste. So hysteria, right, from the 19th century, hysteria was one of those sort of trends or ideas. But for me, looking at Big Pharma was about experiencing or examining my own experience, but also looking at the ways that Big Pharma has shaped the ways we think about mental health. Because we have a very crafted narrative that first you have symptoms, then you get a diagnosis, then you get a prescription, and then you feel better. Mm-hmm. Except that our diagnostic rates have gone up in this country tremendously in the last few decades, and we're one of the leading countries in terms of mental illness in the developed world. So if we have this narrative where you take a pill and everything is better, but Americans are not getting better, then there's something wrong with the narrative in some sense, which is what I was interested in looking at.
That seems like an important point.
Yeah.
The history of treatment of mental illness in the United States is not a great story in and of itself. And the history, as Wayne has documented in his own reporting over the years, is a history of really sort of brutality, for lack of a better word. Is there something about the American experience with this that is unique, that still lingers with us today, that still shapes the way we talk and treat these issues?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the idea of the brutality or of silence and erasure, that continues, right? When we tend to silence patients if they say something that we don't like to hear. We'll say, oh, you know, you're making that up, or you're crazy. There's a lot of erasure of stories of mental illness. We tend to favor narratives that demonize mental health patients. So the narratives that we share most often are narratives often surrounding mass violence. We say, oh, that person was crazy, and crazy people do this, except that, you know, it's one person of many. You know, there's millions of people who are diagnosed and medicated for different things. But yeah, for me, looking at the history of mental illness treatment was really important. As a patient, I felt unvalidated and ignored. And I knew that was a trend that, you know, of course we can trace back. So I looked at the history of lobotomy, eugenics, the eugenics movement, as connected to mental illness, the history of asylums, and again, the history of over-medicating and over-prescribing different things to women, I found really fascinating.
So we're almost at the end of the show. There's another message in Quite Mad, and that's what you describe as a beacon of hope and truth for the millions of individuals living with mental illness. What is the hope and truth that you bring through your book?
That we are not broken, that we are not wrong. We are just humans that are trying to get through it. I think the narrative that people often hear is that there's something wrong with you, you need to fix it, you need to pull it together, you need to mind over matter, be stronger. But no, we're just, you know, there's many of us, we're a community, and we're just trying to find the things that we need to make it day to day. And so, if anything, the message that I want to sort of share is a message of normalcy, right? That we all are here together, and that even in your darkest times, or the times where you feel the most unhinged or off from reality, there's a lot of people that have felt that way too, so you're not the only one, and there's some comfort in that.
It's a great message for today.
We got about 10 seconds left. What's next for you?
I am currently working on two new book projects. I got a book of poems going. I got another nonfiction book. The book of poems is a little bit further along, so I can say more about it. It's about witches and historical and pop culture witches. The other one, the memoir, I'm still figuring it out.
We'll have you back when they're done.
Absolutely.
She's Sarah Fawn Montgomery. The book is Quite Mad, an American Pharma Memoir. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org, where you can always catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.